I'm going to call the House Committee on Rules to order and let the record show there is a quorum present. And with that, we have some distinguished representatives here. So we are going to move directly to opening a public hearing. We have two bills that were held over. They're going to go very quickly, but we're going to, for expediency and getting people back to the other jobs they have, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2504. Okay. Go ahead and read a short explanation. We can have our two representatives and actually their guest. Come on up.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, House Bill 2504 deletes the requirement to provide the name of each relative who is 18 years of age or older and not a member of a household, of the household, of the person on the statement of economic interest. It deletes the requirement for certain county, city, and local public officials to file statements of economic interest. Prohibits the Government Ethics Commission from disclosing the home address or home phone number of public safety officer that would be contained in a statement or other information filed with the commission. Ethics legislation adopted in 2007 expanded the information requirements for statements of economic interest filed with the Government Ethics Commission. One of those requirements was the addition of the names of each relative of the person filing the report who was age 18 or older and not a member of the person's household. Concerns have been expressed about the intrusion into privacy of family members and the practical difficulties of obtaining such information in some cases. Ethics legislation in 2007 also added local elected and non-elected public officials in certain communities and counties that had voted against the original state ethics legislation adopted in the 1970s to the list of persons required to file statements of economic interest. That addition led a number of local officials in affected communities to resign from office rather than submit the required information. The changes proposed in HB 2504 applies not only to those local officials added as required filers in 2007, but deletes the filing requirement for substantially all city, county, and other local officials, including those previously required to file statements of economic interest.
And with that, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize. The distinguished people left the room, so you're stuck with us. I am John Huffman, State Representative for District 59 out east. And I appreciate the opportunity to bring an ethics proposal amendment before this committee, House Bill 2504. The new ethics laws that went into effect January 1st of 2008, as you'll hear in testimony and all of you are already aware, it caused quite a turmoil, particularly in rural Oregon, with a lot of planning commissions and city councilors and whatnot resigning their commission because of the intrusion upon their perceived privacy. And so I'm going to, for brevity, I'm going to leave most of the testimony up to Mayor Denny Ross in a second, but we can let Representative Cliff Bentz go ahead of me. Or Denny.
He can't go ahead of you any longer.
He can't. That would be impossible.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Cliff Bentz, representative from District 60. I received expressions of concern regarding the existing bill, not the new one, but the existing bill from the small cities of Halfway, Richland, Nissa, Haines, Baker City, Vail, Huntington, and Hines. And I attended various of their meetings over the course of last spring and summer, listening to many different descriptive phrases about the legislature, which were not positive. And I repeatedly had opportunity to express to them that it wasn't me and that had anything to do with the original bill. I also received expressions of concern from numerous circuit court judges who were extraordinarily concerned about members of their family being disclosed to the public, in particular those who they may have sentenced to some period of time in jail and worried about when they got out finding that information and trying to retaliate against their family members. Of course, as we know, when you're from a small community, there's a very, very limited pool of people willing to serve in these jobs. And as I heard over and over and over again, when we lose a few of them because of their concerns, we lose sometimes the folks that have to do the work. So I would strongly support 2504, I think it is, and some changes, not to get away from the disclosure that I know we need, but to possibly take into account these folks' concerns. Thank you very much.
Okay. I'm Mayor Denny Ross from Maupin, and it did affect us much the way it affected many other cities in the east and the west side of the mountains. The morning of our March City Council meeting is when we read in the paper that Elgin had lost a lot of their councilors, or their Planning Commission and councils, I believe. And I didn't think much about it until we got to the City Council that night, and I noticed that there was almost the whole Planning Commission out there, and one by one they got up and read their resignations. So we were without the five, and the council was getting kind of antsy, and I said to them, I promise, guys, these guys are going to fix it. They have to, because it's just not a very good bill the way it stands right now. Now, I had no idea how that was going to happen, but we started working on it. And in the meantime, we started working on a new planning commission. So the staff and I and the councilors went and approached everybody that looked cheerful and 98.6 and vertical and twisted their arms. And from a field of seven, the following council meeting, we replaced the five that had resigned. So I was very, very proud of the city of Maupin at that time. The requirements are still with us. There's still a little bit of carping on somebody who files his name on the top, the date right underneath it, and puts NA all the way through, because in a town of 500, there's not much occasion to go to Hawaii and watch a golf match or anything like that. I think that this is a good requirement. I've explained to these guys how innoxious all these requirements are. And as somebody who once dealt with nuclear weapons, this is a walk in the park. Thank you very much, and keep on fixing this thing, please.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mayor Ross. Senate Bill 10 did create a lot of havoc in rural Oregon. My communities aren't that different from what they were over on the coast and in southern Oregon. Just in closing, I would say that I have committed to other people working on similar ethics reform bills to work with them, so that hopefully 2504 will actually get worked into a good comprehensive bill that we can move forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Seeing none, thank you for being here. I see that another one of the representatives made it, who came in real quickly for a short time. It's a different bill, and I offered him the same. So I'm going to leave this one open. We'll come back. And I'm going to open a public hearing to get his testimony on one of the ones we held over from last week, HGR 36. And we will get order again as soon as we get some of these people to where they need to go. So I'm going to open that hearing on HGR 6. And Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee. For the record, my name is David Edwards. I'm the State Representative from House District 30, which encompasses Greater Hillsborough, North Plains, and Roy and Verbort in Washington County. I appreciate your indulgence in mixing up your agenda to allow me to testify on HDR 36. Since you heard from my co-chief sponsor, Representative Bruhn, on Friday, I won't go into great detail about the bill. Let me just cover a few quick points. First of all, the main purpose of the bill is to redistrict and ensure that redistricting is not the subject of partisan manipulation. In our opinion, the current redistricting process gives the majority party undue authority, and regardless of the party in power, the common practice is to draw safe districts that favor its members. And this often results in districts that are safe for the incumbent party, but in turn tend to promote ideological rigidity rather than deliberation and compromise. Our alternative is House Joint Resolution 36, which is a bipartisan legislative referral that would end the practice of the majority party drawing district boundaries. If approved by the voters, this referral would institute a new redistricting process in 2012, in which districts would be determined by a nonpartisan commission of retired judges. I believe Representative Bruhn went into the details of how that would be done, so I'm not going to cover that territory. I will say that there are a number of guiding principles in the bill in terms of drawing the legislative map. Chief among those principles is that city and towns would be kept whole insofar as it's practicable. Districts must be contiguous and adhere to natural geographic boundaries, and there must be ample opportunities for public input. Most critically, the commission could not take into account the effects of redistricting on incumbents or political parties. A couple of final points. In the last round of redistricting, shortly after 2000, there were over 150 lawsuits in at least 40 states, and this referral is intended to help minimize the chance of such a lawsuit here in Oregon. And currently there are 12 states which give first and final authority for redistricting to a group other than the state legislature. California recently passed a bill authorizing a similar nonpartisan commission structure for redistricting, and that bill received support by the League of Women Voters, the ACLU, and other good government groups. So I commend HD 36 to your consideration, and hope that you will pass that on to the floor and eventually to the voters.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Representative, for bringing this bill forward. I've got great respect for you and your co-sponsor of the bill. And when he was testifying before us last week, he made some comments, and I wanted to be sure that they were consistent with your beliefs. And one of them was that his party is usually leading the way in terms of doing the right thing. And I wanted to make sure that you agree with that assessment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, I also understand that Rep. Bruin said that he was carrying my water last Friday. I just want to emphasize that we submitted this bill together in 2007 and have resubmitted this session. And while I hesitate to contradict Representative Bruin directly, I will say that in this case we are leading the way together.
Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I was just wondering if you had any words of wisdom from history to share with us, or any quotes or anything that's relevant.
Mr. Chair, Representative Reed, nothing comes to mind immediately, but I'll be happy to submit a quote from Shakespeare tomorrow.
I'll be looking forward to it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions? None seen. Thank you very much.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair, committee.
Yep. We're going to close the hearing on HGR 36. We'll come back to it shortly. And then we will take the last two people for our House Bill 2504, Cappy Eaton and Ron Burkson. He was here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Cappy Eaton, governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I should probably go before Ron anyway, because he'll have lots more to say than I have. I'm going to be very brief. During the sessions of 2005 and 2007, we worked closely with a lot of individuals and organizations to improve the Oregon ethics laws. At that time, public opinion strongly indicated both distrust and disgust at certain lobbying practices. And the funding and the operation of the then Standards and Practices Commission limited the follow-up of complaints. Senate Bill 10, 2009, put in place a much stronger ethics commission, greater limits on lobbying and gift activities, and more emphasis on the filing of statements of economic interest. The problem that House Bill 2504 seeks to remedy is too wide a net requirement for statements. Local entities, particularly those with volunteers, have suffered widespread resignations because of the required statement filings. While the League supports transparency and accountability for public officials, the implementation around Senate Bill 10 was too encompassing. However, I need to add something to my testimony. We are concerned with the removal of the City Council and County Commissioners that is in this bill. And while we support the bill generally, we would hope you would take a look at that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ron. Chair Roland, for the record, Ron Burson, Executive Director for the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. And I appreciate the committee's time here. On House Bill 2504, the agency, I think, has always been supportive of the removal of relatives and members of household off the statements of economic interest, whereas local jurisdictions found a lot of problems with those requirements. We as an agency also found a lot of problems with that in trying to get the forms filed with our office. And so I think we've come out prior to this and said we are in favor of that. But I also have concerns about the removal of local public officials from the requirement of filing the statement of economic interest. I think we need to back up just a second and talk a little bit about the reason for a statement of economic interest. The purpose of the statement isn't for the Ethics Commission. It's really for the citizens of the local jurisdictions. And one of the largest areas of complaints that the Commission receives is on conflicts of interest. And as you know, the information other than relatives and members of household is really questions around where a public official's interests lie inside of their jurisdiction. So a person from a city would only need to be responding to their interest inside of their jurisdiction. Now, we as statewide officials have a wider berth than that. I mean, we're the complete state of Oregon, but you're not talking about assets you may have outside of your jurisdiction. And anyway, these statements give the citizens a chance to look at a public official and see where their interests lie and actually decide, are they making decisions that could be benefiting them personally? In other words, are there conflicts of interest? And this is where many of the people use the Government Ethics Commission, is to look at those reports and find out, are there local city councils, are there local governments actually operating correctly and declaring these conflicts of interest? Without these reports, I think it would be very difficult for a person inside of the local jurisdictions to know what a city councilor, what they owned in town, or where their other assets, what businesses they're associated with. It'd be very difficult for them to find that out. And that's really what the statement is. It's a resource for the people of the state of Oregon. And so I, too, have concern about that. This requirement, I mean, I think it's fine to put it in the statute, but to prevent the disclosure of home addresses and telephone numbers, those are not, or have they ever been, requirements of the Statement of Economic Interest. You've never had to use your home address or your home telephone number. So that's really the testimony I had today.
Any question for these witnesses? Seeing none, thank you both. Was there anyone here who didn't sign up that wished to speak to House Bill 2504? Seeing none, we're going to close that public hearing on House Bill 2504. And just a kind of a brief explanation. Last week, we spent a lot of time on bills that had to do with initiative reform. A few of us on the committee and others on the committee who are interested are going to kind of talk about that. Some of those which we anticipate moving forward, we'll get a hold of other people. But we wanted to get the kind of the breadth of all the things that were out there, and that's why we had all of those bills. We're doing the same this week with some of the ethics things, anticipating that Senate Bill 30 will be arriving here shortly to this committee, and to see if there's anything from all these other things we had that we think need to be added, subtracted, or a separate bill. So that's kind of what we're starting about today. But we do need to finish up last week, so we're going to go back. Oh, and that House Bill 2010, just so people know, there were a series of amendments. It was basically going to change the bill completely. They haven't come out yet and aren't ready, so we are going to pull that off. If you looked at it, it looked a whole lot like 2005. It will not when it comes back, and as soon as we get those amendments, we'll let people see that so they know what we're really talking about when we get closer. So we will not be listening to House Bill 2010 today. With that, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3451, and we'll have a short explanation from our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 3451 allows the county clerk to electronically scan but not tally ballots prior to the date of an election in accordance with a security plan approved by the Secretary of State. It requires the county clerk to add security procedures to the county's election security plan for electronic scanning without automatically tallying ballots before the date of an election. And it prohibits the electronic scan of ballots prior to the date of election unless the Secretary reviews and approves that security plan.
And with that, we'll just go down our list. Tim Scott. And we heard from Linda Smith last week from Klamath County. Annette Newingham and Cappy Eaton. This was from last week's group. If they're here, if they want to speak.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Tim Scott. I'm Director of Elections for Multnomah County. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on House Bill 3451 relating to early ballot scanning. Multnomah County supports this bill with the Dash 1 amendments that will allow clerks to scan ballots into a vote tally system up to 7 days prior to the election day. Currently, ballot scanning cannot begin until election day and must continue until all of the ballots have been tallied. In elections with high turnout and unusually long ballots, as happened in the November 2008 general election, that meant that ballot scanning and tallying continued for 57 hours straight in Multnomah County. This required 4 12-hour shifts and 1 9-hour shift of 10 to 15 people on each shift for the scanning and tallying processes. Each of the 6 ballot scanners ran for 57 hours straight for a total of 342 machine hours. Some of the benefits that we could get out of early scanning: more complete results at 8 p.m. on election day. All ballots received prior to election day and some received on election day would be included in the first results report at 8 p.m. In November 2008, this would have been around 300,000 ballots instead of the actual 98,000 that were included in the first results report at 8 p.m. on election day. This would have eliminated the impression that the Smith-Merkley race was too close to call. More time to deal with ballots that need special handling. If a ballot is not machine readable, there would be more time to begin duplication and or enhancements so that the ballots could be included in the election day totals. Less stress on election workers. With a longer period of time to scan ballots, staff can be scheduled during regular work hours and for shorter shifts. This reduces stress and fatigue and leads to more accurate work. Some of the safeguards that we've put into place in order to prevent the release of early results. Proposed plans for early ballot scanning must be submitted and approved in a security plan already required under statute. Ballot scanning equipment can be configured so that operators cannot print results reports. Premature release of results is already prohibited by statute. Multnomah County urges the House Rules Committee to adopt House Bill 3451 with the Dash 1 amendments. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you.
Kathy. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Cappy Eaton. I'm the Governance Coordinator for the League of Women Voters. I'm here simply to support House Bill 3451 for many of the reasons that have already been given to you. As you might expect, voting and the elections process are very important to the League of Women Voters and to all citizens, and we believe that if we can reduce some of the pressure that is on the counties as they go through that election cycle, and particularly the few days before election, we think that's a very good idea. We think it'll make the process more effective and more efficient. We support the Dash 1 amendments, and we hope you will move 3451 to the floor.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Annette Newingham. I'm the Lane County Clerk. I'm here today representing both the Oregon Association of County Clerks and the Lane County Commissioners in support of the House Bill 3451-1 amendments. The states of Colorado, California, and Virginia have similar statutes, which is important to know that we are not the first ones to suggest this language. This bill with the amended language would provide election officials the ability to scan ballots through the ballot count system prior to election day without initiating any ballot count totals in order to expedite the count and therefore help support timely election results on Election Day. And not to repeat everything that Tim said from Multnomah County, but it's timelier. The key benefits are timelier ballot processing, more significant election results on Election Day, less carryover ballots following Election Day. We also had up to, it took us 3 days to count our ballots because we had longer ballot counts and a series of issues led to a lot of ballots being held over. Overall accuracy in the processing of ballots, and that is really extremely important because when you're working 3 days in a row with staff, you really do jeopardize the detailed process because you get tired. There's just no other way around it, even if you have shifts. Reduction of election costs, which is minimal for overtime. There is some overtime cost because when you're running them overtime for a lot of hours, you're full-time staff. You're going to be paying sometimes. We were paying double time and a half on some of our staff. In addition to that, like Washington County actually rented some equipment, if you have the space to do that. We didn't in Lane County, but they were able to rent some additional ballot counting equipment, which cost $22,000, so that they could run additional machinery because of the high impact on a general election. This would be saved because you wouldn't have to do that. And again, the safeguards, which are important, that election officials would be required to submit procedures for early scanning in the security plan and would have to receive approval from the Secretary of State once submitted. And our current statutes already do provide that it's an election offense to give out early election results prior to 8 p.m., and that's current statutes.
Representative Girard.
Ms. Newingham, can you tell me how you scan the ballots without counting them, or are you actually counting them but not disclosing the count?
Chair Roblin, Representative Girard, yes, there. It depends on the election system there happens to be. We have three election systems, three, maybe four. We have ESNS, we have Sequoia, and we have the HART system. The HART system, which currently is required, they actually have to scan the ballots in early. There is no choice. That is the process, and they take the chip later in order to do the election results on Election Day. So they're going through a similar process and have been doing that since we've had HART in our state. The other counties, what happens is there's a separate process to produce the election results. So in Lane County, I can give you an example. We scan the ballots through the ballot count machine, and it'll say you're counting this many ballots, but there are no results. You don't know what the outcome is at all. And that process is done on Election Day just prior to releasing the results for the 8 p.m.
So you have to go back and recount the ballots. Even though you've counted the total number of ballots, you still have to go back and recount all of the ballots to get who they're voting for.
Chair Roblin, Representative Girard, no, we do not have to recount the ballots. The very process of scanning the ballots through the ballot counters, it keeps it, like, whether it's a HART system, which then it's on a chip or on a different piece of equipment that has to later be taken to another reporting process to produce results, or in our situation where we actually scan in the ballot counters, and then when you have to do a separate program totally to do the reports, it's the tabulation is actually occurring, and that's part of the Dash One amendments, which it clarifies that, and then so we don't have to rescan it. And the benefit to that in particular is that when you run the ballots through the ballot counter and you wait till Election Day, voters don't always follow directions. In fact, a good percentage of them do not, and there's a lot of enhancing and duplication that has to occur. And you don't even know for sure about that until Election Day when you're running those ballots through the ballot counters. If you were able to do it earlier on, you would identify the ones that actually didn't get marked properly so they could go back to the pre-inspection teams, do the enhancement and duplication so there isn't that backlog that we experienced. We had over about 12,000 ballots that had to be duplicated and enhanced, more than that, actually, in Lane County, and that slows the process down, and you're not aware of which ones those are until you can actually scan them through the ballot counter.
Mr. Chair, I'm still confused. Do you just have to press a button? In other words, to get the results? Or I'm not quite sure how you're getting the results from something you've already scanned but not counted, but it is recording the results somewhere that you can access without rescanning the ballot.
Is it okay? Maybe Tim can answer the question. You know, because even though we have different systems, we have similar processes, and perhaps he might be able to explain it a little bit.
Sorry, I'm not picking on
No,
you.
It's okay. It's detailed. It's okay. A good question.
Chair Roblin, Representative Girard, 34 of the 36 counties use systems that do tally the ballots while they are being scanned. That's the reason for the -1 amendment. If the bill passed as it is, it wouldn't do those 34 counties any good because we cannot separate the tallying process and the scanning process. What we can control is when the results are released, and we can make modifications to our system that would not allow the operators of the equipment to produce results reports, but the data is in the machine.
One final one. So all you, at 8 o'clock, you've put X number of ballots through the scanner. They're all done. All you have to do in a variety of ways, depending on the county, is to press another program button, and you're going to get the results of the election. Do I have it?
Chair Roblin, Representative Girard, yes.
Okay.
That's basically it. There's a few more steps that are required, but ultimately, it's up to us when the tally system will release the results.
Thank you all very much,
Representative Berger.
Okay. And thank you, because this is prompted. I didn't get this. He may have gotten it, but I haven't yet. That's what you're currently doing. Is that correct?
Representative Roblin, Representative Berger, what we are currently doing is we cannot start scanning the ballots until Election Day.
In the morning.
I believe the rule is that we can start at 12:01 a.m. on Election Day. But up until that point, we had hundreds of thousands of ballots sitting there waiting to go through the scanning machine, and we couldn't start until Election Day.
Okay, so if you'll indulge me so I get this. What this bill proposes is that instead of a certain number of hours before that 8 p.m. deadline, it would be a certain number of days before that 8 p.m. deadline that you could run the ballots but not the tallies.
We would be tallying, but we would not be producing results.
One of the questions that I have is public records. If you're running these through, are you creating a public record under our public records law that potentially could cause issues, if you know what I mean?
Can I take that?
Sure.
Chair Roblin, Representative Berger, that's a good question, but no, we do not produce election results. So it isn't something that is a public record because we haven't produced it yet. We would not be able to produce it because by law we cannot release results till 8 p.m. on Election Day. The machines are tabulating, but we're not seeing it. Even our system right now, we don't have, ours is capable. There is nothing that the operators can see the results. It's a separate process.
Thank you. One more question. So what am I getting during those 2 weeks after the ballots are out when I go on and my county clerk tells me how many have been returned? Is that something they're just hand counting by precinct? Or is that something spit out by the election return, by the tallying machine, the count?
Chair Roblin, Representative Berger, what you're getting is the return of ballots, because when ballots are returned to us, we actually have to give activity on the voter registration. We have to say, your ballot has come
back. Just like in the old days when they'd say, somebody has voted when you'd go in.
Right, but
is
we...
That,
Your ballot hasn't been processed other than to look at your signature. First step is just to give activity to the voter registration system, which is a statewide voter registration system in the state of Oregon. So activity is given, and we know how many ballots have come back. And then the signature is viewed. If there's any problems with signatures, we send letters out. But none of the process, then we can open up the ballot and do the separation up to the seventh day prior to the election. That's current law. We can do everything short of sending the ballots through the ballot counters, with the exception of the HART system, which is because they have to be able to do that with their system. It's a different process.
One more.
Yep.
34 of 36 are under HART system already?
No.
Or not under HART system?
Chair Roebling, Representative Berger, 34 of the 36 counties do not use the HART system. The HART system is the only one that, by administrative rule, the Secretary of State's office has allowed to scan ballots through their ballot scanners prior to Election Day, because the system is able to separate the scanning and tallying processes. The Secretary of State's office has ruled that that system, which can separate its processes, is allowed to go ahead and process ballots through the scanners up to 7 days prior. However, the 34 of the 36 counties are not able to separate that process. So,
one more.
Of course.
Please be indulgent. Other states, you mentioned that there are states, and we are the only vote-by-mail, totally vote-by-mail state, are we not? So if we had this dual system that we used to have, where you have a high percentage of vote-by-mail and a high percentage of going, you know, whatever percentage of going to the ballot, it seems to me that these problems that we're trying to deal with would be multiplied many-fold. In other words, the poll workers working many, many hours. Am I right in that? And the results delayed even longer.
Chair Roebling, Representative Berger, yes. I was an election official in Virginia prior to coming to Oregon, and we were under a system where we had polling place based elections, and the volume of absentee ballots just kept increasing. In 2007, in the 2007 legislative session, Virginia made the change so that the largest, and it really is a large county issue. They made the change so that Fairfax County, which is the largest county in Virginia, could process ballots through the scanner prior to Election Day. And this would be absentee ballots in their case. For us, it's all of our ballots. So states are starting to realize that with more interest in vote-by-mail and more absentee voting, something has to be done about this huge pile of paper ballots that need to be processed and get timely results.
Other questions? I have just one, and that you get all these ballots back and they come in from different parts of your county and they have different ballots because different things are being voted on. Do they have to go through the machine one group at a time with the same ballot? Or does the machine know from ballot to ballot which ones they are and tally it?
Chair Roebling, members of the committee, it depends, really. There are variances. In Lane County, ours are what we call mixed mode, and each ballot has something that identifies the precinct. So we don't have to sort by precinct. It will give results by precinct, but we do not have to sort by precinct. But the majority of the other counties in Oregon do still manually sort by precinct, and then process them that way, and I believe Multnomah County does it that way still.
So if you're sorting by precinct, you're going to be doing that each time you put this through, and there's going to be a separate tally someplace for each of those counties that you have to keep secure to add to the others that are going to come through for that precinct later?
Chair Roebling, the Short answer is no. I mean, the machine takes care of it all. I mean, it when we've sorted by precinct, each time we run a batch of a stack of precinct ballots through, we run a header card through, and that tells the machine that every single ballot that comes after that, until we tell it it's a new precinct, is going to be in that precinct.
So that's part of that work you do ahead of time, as much as you can, in sorting. Okay. Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just to make sure that I understand who uses what system, because nobody's asked it yet. Lane County, correct, uses Sequoia. What county uses Hart? And then all the other counties use something else.
Representative Edwards, Yamhill and...
I'm not sure the other one.
I'm not sure if the other one uses Hart, but Yamhill is one of the Hart users, and the rest use ES&S. 32 of the 36 counties are ES&S.
Okay. Thank you. That's it.
Okay. Any other questions for this group? Thank you very much. Next, we have David Jackson, Frank, is it Feville, and Ann Hannes.
Yeah. I'm just curious as to when all the counties made these purchases, why we didn't mandate they all buy the same one.
It's attached.
Local control.
Say that again.
I was just wondering why we didn't mandate that each of these counties buy the same type of machine.
Yeah.
We're almost there.
We're getting close.
Yeah, okay.
As soon as we get... the 32 outliers.
Yeah.
You know, board of the Sequoia system will be there.
Then they can hack the
whole thing. I think it's a bit simpler than that, Representative Edwards. As soon as we're paying the bill, we can tell them what equipment to buy.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I know a great bill that would take us in a step that direction.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. My name is Dave Jackson. I live in Southwest Portland and have a particular interest in promoting the integrity of Oregon elections. I've been involved in issues surrounding election integrity since the 2000 election demonstrated the flaws of the U.S. election system for all the world to see. I want to say that I am not a lobbyist. I'm not a lawyer, I'm not an attorney, I have no economic interest in this issue. I take citizen oversight and election transparency seriously. As an activist, I have spent countless hours in the county election office over the past several election cycles watching the election process unfold before my eyes. I have watched as envelopes containing ballots have received and checked in signatures verified, and the ballots themselves examined by election boards. I have been present during the state-mandated public test, where a test deck of ballots is scanned by all machines to demonstrate that the machines count correctly and that there are no votes lurking inside the electronic ballot box before the start of the count. After the public test on election day, the official count begins. In addition to my own personal involvement in election observation, I have also recruited and organized other concerned citizens in one-third of Oregon's counties. I am here today because HB 3451, which I think is a very bad bill, would change the process in ways that would not enhance public oversight by interested citizens like myself. This bill would also open the door for some individuals to gain access to early vote counts and perhaps use that knowledge for GOTV efforts or last-minute advertising. This is not to suggest that any of the current county clerks fail to adhere to the highest professional standards, but human nature being what it is, it is hard to predict future events when there is an opportunity such as that arising from HB 3451 to gain and use inside information. As the committee knows, HB 3451 would allow scanning but not tallying of ballots prior to election day. This proposal puts the security and integrity of Oregon's election system at grave risk and displays lack of knowledge about how the equipment used in most of our counties, including our largest ones, actually works. It also makes citizen observation much more difficult. What is being proposed is to start the scanning process as much as 10 days in advance of election day. There is to be scanning only, but not tabulating. There is a requirement that a security plan be approved by the Secretary of State before such process could begin. However, in 32 of Oregon's 36 counties where ES&S equipment is used with the Unity Election Management System, EMS, there is no way to put a wall between scanning and tabulating. Tabulation happens as the ballots are fed through the scanner. A printer is attached to each scanner that can print out the running total of the scanner. There is a separate module in the Unity EMS that accumulates the totals from all the scanners and reports the election results. But someone wanting a sneak peek at elections results could simply take a look at the printouts from the scanners and get a rough, quick overview of the early counts for any particular race that is of particular interest. They could do this even though the election report module, ERM, was not accessed because it was behind a locked door in the room where the tabulating computer is kept. An excellent example of prized but sensitive information being accessed inappropriately out of sheer human curiosity occurred during the 2008 campaign when low-level State Department personnel snooped into Barack Obama's passport records. I recognize that there may be frustration in the aftermath of Multnomah County's slow count during the November 2008 general election. Remember that around 80,000 ballots arrived at the Multnomah County election office afternoon on election day. Plus, there was a flood in the lower level that required the relocation of the election boards. This was a challenging situation in one county, but is not likely to reoccur. There is no need to put the security and integrity of Oregon's elections at risk in the rush to get results on election day or night. The priority should be to do it right rather than sooner. Only two counties have systems that can scan without also simultaneously sending data to the central tabulator. These are Curry and Yamhill, which recently purchased systems from the Hart InterCivic. This vendor has designed systems that allow for scanning to take place without tabulation. At the proper moment on election day, an election worker would simply press the go button to start the tabulating function. The ballot images can be stored for weeks without any total being available. Because of this system architecture, it might be possible to implement the provisions of HB 3451 in those two counties in a secure way. There is no bulletproof way to implement this bill in other counties. HB 3451 produces an unacceptable level of risk to the security and integrity of Oregon's elections that far outweigh any perceived gains from faster reporting of election results. Another concern with this bill is that it makes observations of the count by citizens, campaigns, and candidates much more difficult. I have been an observer of the count at the election office, actually at several election offices, since 2004, and would find it difficult to observe the count and attest to its integrity if it was started so far in advance of election day. Currently, the public test takes place before the count begins early in the morning of election day, and then the official count begins. There is no lapse of time between the public test and the start of the count. The equipment does not sit idle and unobserved between the public test and the official count. There is no opportunity for changes to be made in the software or hardware between public tests and the count. If the scanning were to be started so far in advance of Election Day, it would be difficult, if not impossible, to demonstrate the lack of change between the conditions of the system when the scanning was initiated and the final drive towards getting results on Election Day or night. On a side note, I would like to mention that I have received reliable reports from volunteer observers that in at least one county that uses the ESNS system, this is Josephine County, there has been a policy of requiring citizen observers to remain inside the election office on Election Day once scanning has begun until the first release of results at 8 p.m. This policy was put in place to make sure that no hint of election results could leak out prior to the first release of the vote count at 8 p.m. Now we are being told that such stringent precautions might not be necessary. The scanning can start well in advance of Election Day without people coming and going from the election office as normal, and there is no possibility that the early scanning results could leak out. There is also some inconsistency about timelines in the amended statute. The language in Section 2 refers to the counting to, quote, begin on Election Day, and the new provisions under HB 3451 mention 10 days before the election. The language in Section 3.1 and the proposed change in Section 3.2 have similar problems. I urge members of this committee to vote no on House Bill 3451 and not move it forward.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much. There are two pieces of testimony that were left here last week that we entered into the record as well. I want to make sure people have those. From Ellen Thiessen and from Frank, I guess it's Gild. Ann Hannes and Barry Pack.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ann Hannes, and I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties.
Yeah.
We urge your support for House Bill 3451 with the -1 amendment because the bill will save money by some reduction in overtime expenses, and for larger counties, the need to rent extra ballot counting equipment. It improves the efficiency, accuracy of the ballot counting process, and lastly, it results in more timely results while also requiring security when tallying the vote. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Barry Pack, Deputy Secretary of State. You should have a letter from Secretary Brown supporting the -1 amendments to House Bill 3451, and I won't repeat any of the testimony that she's providing in that letter, but I did want to focus a little bit on the security questions. I think Mr. Jackson raised some important questions, and they were questions that we had when we first took a look at the bill. We have had a variety of conversations about what might be an appropriate level of security procedure and protocol that counties could take. We did have a very good meeting with Jim Scott and Multnomah County and Chair Wheeler there about some of the ways that we might make sure that the tally is not accessible to anyone during an extended counting period or scanning period, and while I obviously can't go into any details about what that security arrangement would look like on the record, I think we did come away from that meeting confident that this would not put our elections unduly at risk, and we urge your adoption of the -1 amendments and support of the bill.
Questions of either of these witnesses? Thank you very much. That does it for the witnesses for House Bill 3451. Is there anyone here who didn't sign up that wanted to speak to 3451? Then we are going to close our hearing on House Bill 3451. And we're going to open our hearing on HGR 36. And we can have a short explanation. We've already had two testimonies on this one from two people. And the only people left are Kathy Eaton and Bruce Miller, if they want to come forward, we'll have them coming here while I give a short explanation.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, H.J.R. 36, right?
Yep.
Proposes a constitutional amendment establishing a panel of retired judges acting as special masters to adjust the boundaries of state legislative and congressional districts following each federal decennial census. Establishes criteria for redistricting, directs the panel to submit a redistricting plan to the Legislative Assembly, comment prior to adopting a final redistricting plan, requires unanimous vote by the panel to approve a final redistricting plan, requires the final plan to be filed with the Secretary of State, directs the Secretary of State to submit the final redistricting plan to the people for their approval or rejection at the next general election as if it were proposed initiative law, and establishes a procedure for appointing a new panel of special masters to propose new redistricting plan in the event the redistricting plan is rejected by the voters. Oregon Constitution currently requires the Legislative Assembly to apportion itself following each federal decennial census, subject to review upon petition of any elector filed with the Supreme Court. If the Supreme Court determines that the reapportionment does not comply with constitutional requirements and all applicable law, the Court's opinion must direct the Secretary of State to draft a legislative reapportionment in accordance with constitutional requirements and all applicable law. The Secretary's reapportionment plan is to be reviewed by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court may then further correct the reapportionment if it considers correction to be necessary. Neither existing Oregon constitutional or statutory law directly covers reapportionment of congressional districts, although that provision is also a part of H.J.R. 36.
With that, Kathy, you want to start?
Chair Roblin, member of the committee, for the record, Cappy Eaton, governance chair for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I've given Chair Roblin a copy of our recent redistricting study. If any of you would like a copy, if you will let me know, we'll be happy to provide you with one. The League rather comprehensively looked at redistricting, not only in Oregon, but across the country, to see what other states did. As you know, the Constitution provides that the legislature will provide a redistricting plan, but if they can't agree on a plan, or if they have a plan and the governor vetoes it, it goes to the Secretary of State with rather strict guidelines and timelines for the Secretary of State to come up with a redistricting plan, and that has happened three out of the last four census times in Oregon. Our members discussed the current plan, and we looked at the various methods for redistricting around the country. Many states use panels or commissions, and that's fairly common. H.J.R. 36 would replace the current system with a panel of special masters made up of retired judges. It also presents some rather vague criteria for the realignment of districts, while the League supports rather strict criteria for the very important work of ensuring equal and fair representation in our form of government. There is a problem with using retired judges, which was distinctly stated to this committee by the Oregon Court Administration in his testimony March 30th regarding the use of retired judges to review challenged ballot titles. In the first place, there aren't enough retired judges to do that kind of work. And secondly, apparently, if you go to the next group, it would require additional funding. The Public Commission on the Legislature made a recommendation to the 2007 legislature suggesting that there be a five-person panel to redistricting. Or you're going to have to do it in 2 years. And it's our concern that the legislature needs to be thinking about it. But we feel that changing the process should have a lot of research and discussion. And we do not feel that H.J.R. 36 is the way to go. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm senior staff counsel in the Office for the State Court Administrator. I'd be remiss if I didn't point out that this concept adds another task to the Supreme Court, but I'm actually here on a more interesting issue that you may want to consider as you study this bill. And that issue is the lack of a safety valve in the event that a panel of 24 judges is not available. At any given time, we have approximately 100 to 120 retired judges. Of those, usually around 25 are active Plan B judges. You probably wouldn't be able to use the active Plan B judges as a special master because they would then be paid by both the judicial department and the legislative branch, and you would have separation of power issues. So that reduces the pool that's available for selection. The pool is further reduced by the qualifications that are set out in the bill. Having never held partisan political office, I can tell you that a number of our judges have been attorney general, have sat in the legislature, things of that nature. They could not be part of the pool. Have not held political party office, have not changed party affiliation since they were first elected or appointed to the bench. I can't tell you if or how many have done that, but I think we can guess that probably some have. And then no income over the last 12 months from legislature, Congress, political party, political candidate. Again, I can't tell you who falls in that category. But you can see the problem is it shrinks the pool of retired judges for the Supreme Court to look at. And our concern is that you may end up with a situation where you can't get the 24. Then what do you do? There's no safety valve in the measure on how you handle redistricting if that doesn't happen. There are a couple other issues to think about, especially when we think about a small pool of judges. Having the Supreme Court select them by lot may not be the most efficient way to do it, because you can see casting lot after lot after lot as you try to find people who fit within the party affiliation and whatnot. There's an issue in there when the voters vote on the plan, should they reject it, it's supposed to go to another panel or back to the special master, and it might be worthwhile to clarify in the measure that the next group of special masters can be drawn from the existing pool. If you run it back and have to get a whole other pool of 24, it's going to be difficult. In Section 8, they talk about a court action, which, of course, you have now. It can go to the Supreme Court, but in the event that certain things happen, a party could file an action in court, but it doesn't specify which court. And I think there could be some confusion over that as people try to decide, do we go to circuit court, do we go to court of appeals, do we go to the Supreme Court like they do now. The court can order a new plan, but it's not clear in there whether they would use order the existing panel to come up with a new plan or whether we need to have a new one. There are a couple minor miscellaneous things. There's no residency requirement in this. I can tell you that we have judges who are retired that live out of the state, and so it's something to consider whether you want a residency requirement. And this is just my reading of it. It says Oregon state judges or federal judges. I don't know that Oregon, in that phrase, modifies federal judges. LC may have a different opinion on how they drafted that, but that raised a question to me whether you're opening it up to all federal judges or just judges who sat in Oregon federal courts.
Any questions? I appreciate your testimony. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
You also received some testimony from Daniel Meek, and he spoke with me just after the meeting last time and to point out that this does change the Constitution in a slightly different way. We have had multiple-person districts in the past, 1971. Our Constitution allows for it. This bill would change that by taking it out and making they will all be single-person districts. So that's another little issue that came about that I thought people should know about. With that, is there anyone else here that was wanting to speak to HJR 36? Seeing none, we're going to close our hearing on HJR 36. And We will open a public hearing on House Bill 3011. With that, we'll have a short explanation. And Representative Stiegler, if you'd like to come forward.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 3011 modifies the definition of legislative or administrative interest, adds a definition of candidate for purposes of government ethics laws, and adds candidate to the scope of application of various ethics provisions currently applicable to public officials. Prohibits public official or candidates from receiving any gift from a source with legislative or administrative interest. Increases the exemption from the gift definition for allowed value of unsolicited token or awards of appreciation from $25 to $50. Exempts food and alcoholic beverage from the definition of gift for purposes of ethics laws. Expands the list of public officials required to file statements of economic interest. Modifies the source of income information requirement in the statement of economic interest, and deletes the requirement to provide names of household members and relatives on the statement of economic interest filed under ORS 244.050. Also prohibits the Government Ethics Commission from making statements available in searchable format on the Internet. In 2007, the Legislative Assembly made substantial changes to Oregon government ethics laws, including changes in the definition of gift and exemptions to the definition of gift. The content of the Statement of Economic Interest also substantially modified in 2007 as to sources of income and requirements to identify household members and relatives. House Resolution 3011 seeks to revisit some of those 2007 changes in Oregon's government ethics laws.
And with that, Representative Stiegler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Judy Stiegler. I'm state representative from House District 54. And I was supposed to have a partner in crime here, Representative Berger, but she has deserted me. So I get to do
she
this.
She called away to the...
She did. She assured me it wasn't intentional. At any rate, early on in the session, Representative Berger approached me to work with her on some on drafting some amendments to the ethics laws that were drafted last session. And just as a little bit of background, I served approximately 3 years on the State Ethics Commission, finishing my term, I think, in late or mid-December, and having chaired it for the last about year and a half of my tenure on that commission. So I'm have fairly intimate knowledge with the workings of the state ethics laws, and I know that Representative Berger had served on an interim work group aimed at looking at how some of the new changes were working and whether there needed to be some additional fixes. So this was our effort at it. I'm quite aware that there are other iterations. Senate Bill 30 has just come through the Senate side of the legislature, and what I will tell you is our efforts were aimed at trying to address what we saw as some of the omissions, as well as maybe some of the areas that we saw as becoming more problematic. And I'm just going to walk through and highlight a few of those, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if anybody has any questions. Committee Administrator gave a pretty thorough and complete overview. One of the things I wanted to highlight was the fact that what we did do in this was to very specifically define what a candidate is. There had been, apparently this had been a growing issue of some question. Some candidates assumed they were, some assumed they were not covered. This was to make it very clear who was a candidate and that they were subject to the ethics laws and the reporting requirements. An additional area was that we dealt with the whole area of gifts, particularly in the food and beverage area, because that had seemed to be one of the areas coming out of the last session that was most problematic. What we opted for was a food and non-alcoholic beverage, exempting that, putting that back outside the definition of a gift. And there was some rationale there, I think, In our discussions with a variety of people, we felt that probably it was the alcoholic beverage that elevated the level of cost and that kind of, and the idea that these were these lavish functions and affairs. And our main goal was to make it really clear that we weren't intending the sort of meet and greets that you go to receptions and things like that,
you know, that what we were really looking at was those sort of egregious kinds of situations where that you heard about occasionally where there were $200 dinners and those kind of things. Additionally, one of the other major areas that we looked at was who is subject to the SEI filings. One of the areas that both Representative Berger and I felt very strongly about, and this is probably where we might be viewed as being a little bit more rigid and more strict than even existing law, was that those public officials who had some ability to either they have budgetary kinds of authorization and or they had the ability to have their position questioned as to, you know, their, I guess, influence, undue influence from outside sources, that those folks should all be subject to, particularly when they're in charge of public monies, that they should be subject to SEI filings. And there's a, you'll see that we probably doubled or tripled the list of folks, but a lot of them have to do with their agency heads, their heads of commissions, their heads, their administrative officers who deal with budgetary issues and that kind of thing. There's a logic to this. It matches other parts of our current law, people who are responsible for certain things. Probably the one entity and all of that that might cause some folks a little bit of consternation is the addition of elected members of school boards. But in reality, they were one of the few elected groups who do have direct control over budgets and state monies who had been excluded from the reporting requirements previously. So they were added in. Another area that we made, I think, is a fairly significant shift from prior existing laws with respect to the QPODs or the quarterly reports that were required last session in an effort to try to mirror the reports that lobbyists have to make regarding, you know, connections with and activities with legislators and other persons involved in government. What we wanted to do was to make it clear that we really thought this was most logically aimed at people who had sort of the maximum ability to be influenced, and that was your statewide elected officials, including state legislators, both the Senate and the House of Representatives. So we narrowed the field there. Where we broadened it for the annual report, the Statement of Economic Interest, we narrowed it for these quarterly reports because, again, it was our thought, both from my experience and from Representative Berger's, that those QPODs were really designed to do was to track and to mirror with the lobbyist reporting requirements that they're under. Just a couple of other spots. Let's see here. We did do some adjustments. We raised from $50 to $100 what was needed to be reported on those. From the SEI filing, one of the biggest problematic areas, and I think this has also been addressed in Senate Bill 30, is the listing of relatives in particular on the SEI statement and the members of household persons who are 18 years of age or older. And so those we did delete from the requirement. We did not delete the requirement that that persons within the household who have business interests that might, you know, that the filer might have an interest in as well, they're maintained in there. But in particular, one of the most problematic areas that I can assure you last year, sitting on the Ethics Commission, that we had the greatest number of objections, and in fact we had, I think, maybe three different judicial jurisdictions who imposed some kind of order forbidding disclosure of or even dissemination in any way, shape, or form of judicial officers and their listing and of relatives and that kind of thing. So our goal there was to try to avoid some of the problematic areas, but also try to be as transparent as possible. So with that, I will
I want to say a thank you personally to Representative Stiegler and to Representative Berger. Early in the session, I asked and talked with both of them about working on this bill, which is from this committee, just to get stuff on the table so that we would have a really thoughtful idea of the kinds of things that had brought angst around the state and where we thought we could improve or do or where we should relax in those things. And I commend them for all the work. We also have Senate Bill 30 that's coming, and I thought this should be at least on the table when you consider all the work that was done by these people. So I want to thank you personally for putting in the effort and the time ahead of time to have a real conversation about that with Representative Berger. So
thank you, Mr. Both. Chair, and I appreciate that as well. And if I just might add, I think our goal was, and I'm sure it's the goal of this group, is to come up with a comprehensive piece of legislation that addresses some of those concerns. And I think Representative Berger would join me in saying there's no great pride of authorship here. We tried to focus in on areas of concern and areas that we knew had been problematic. So I appreciated the opportunity.
Any other questions? Thank you very much
for
being here and finding the time this afternoon to get here, too.
Yeah, well, thank you for waiting. Shuffling.
And with that, Cappy Eaton, Bruce Bishop, and Ron Burson. There's three chairs. We can share some time.
Members of the committee, for the record, Cappy Eaton, Governance Chair, Coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. House Bill 3011 takes House Bill 2505 another step or two by adding candidates for public office and additional public officials who must file the economic statement. We did not feel, however, unless we missed it, that it removes one of the sticking points of Senate Bill 10, and that's the problem with the local volunteers and relatives and additional other people are not remedied in this particular bill. In addition, we are concerned about the exemption of food and drink in Section 1K, Line 23, on page 3 of the bill. Even though the costs may be small, a substantial influence can occur in those situations. We do support the inclusion of candidates who must adhere to the ethics rules. In a closing comment, there are several bills before this committee, and you will be hearing Senate Bill 30 on Wednesday. And we just recommend that you thoroughly review each of them and come up with some kind of a compromise that can receive public and decision-maker support. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop. I'm appearing on my own behalf and not as a lobbyist, although I have been a registered lobbyist for approximately 21 years in the past. House Bill 3011 makes some constructive changes in government ethics standards, and I'm not going to dwell on those aspects of the bill. Instead, I'd like to draw your attention to some other significant issues in this area of law and to challenge the committee to come up with some solutions to those problems that the bill doesn't currently address. I've identified four basic issues that I'd like to bring to the committee's attention. First, Oregon law applies its conflict of interest requirements to businesses and to businesses with which public officials are associated. The statute, which I've set out here in part, defines what constitutes a business. It excludes certain nonprofit and charitable organizations, but it is, in my view at least, unclear about whether government is a business or when government is a business and when, as a result of that, conflicts of interest that may occur between a public official and a government interest should be disclosed. I think that's an area, and potentially a growing area, that the committee may want to consider. Second, the law relies heavily on the phrase legislative or administrative interest to determine whether or not a gift is permissible. If a donor has a legislative or administrative interest, gifts are limited. If there is no such interest, gifts are not limited at all. So it's a very important criterion in the law, and the law defines a legislative or administrative interest as an economic interest distinct from that of the general public. Unfortunately, in my view, the law doesn't define what constitutes an economic interest. And so we haven't provided guidance really to legislative officials or others about what an economic interest is. In response to questions last year from the Capital Club, the Ethics Commission wrote a formal advisory opinion that explains in part its views of what constitutes an economic interest that would subject a person to the gift limitations under the law. And I've set out for you in my testimony on page 2 the 5 examples that the Commission cites as examples as situations where a person would be considered to have an economic interest. One involves a vendor or a contractor who's involved, who's selling products to government. The second involves a builder or developer that's impacted by local government building permits, zoning, or other land use regulations. The third involves any business or organization that is impacted by funding or regulations overseen by state or local government. That's getting pretty broad. The fourth involves a lobbyist, business organization, state or local agency that is seeking legislative action or could be impacted by legislative action. Again, I think that is quite broad interpretation of what constitutes an economic interest. And then finally, it's any public or private entity that must seek funding or is regulated by a state or local agency. In my view, this interpretation by the Ethics Commission renders the definition of economic interest almost meaningless, because virtually every Oregonian will have an economic interest of this type in state government. I think if that's what we mean, we should say it. We shouldn't use a term like legislative or administrative interest that we then define to be an economic interest and layer on definitions in a way that is confusing to people and makes it very complicated for them to know what standards of behavior are expected from them. Third, the law allows, as an exception to the gift limitations, reasonable expenses when they are paid by governments or certain nonprofit organizations, for public officials to participate in certain events, fact-finding missions, or other meetings. I guess we all know what a reasonable expenditure is, but the law doesn't define it, and it doesn't differentiate reasonable expenses from unreasonable expenses. It provides no guidance as to what is appropriate conduct or inappropriate conduct. I realize that that's difficult to do generally, but it seems to me we're not providing any standard by which people can determine the reasonableness or the legality of the activities in which they're participating. And finally, the law, by and large, regulates the conduct of public officials when they're acting in the capacity of a public official. Now, that makes sense logically, because you don't want to regulate public officials when they're not acting as public officials. But practically, it presents a real problem. I've cited an example for you of legislators. Is there a time when you can say that you are a public official and a time when you can say you are not a public official? And does it make a difference in terms of gift or other expenditures that are made on your behalf? It's a very fine line that the law tries to draw here. And I think, again, it's an example where we haven't provided the guidance that people deserve to know what conduct they're allowed to participate in and what conduct they should not. So the problem I see with this bill, as with current law, is that we're continuing to layer on explanations and definitions and exceptions to the law in a way that makes it very complicated for anybody to really understand what's expected of them as a public official. For those reasons, I would urge the committee to step back, take a breath, and see if there's another approach that can be come up, that you can come up with, that would provide proper guidance for public officials in this area. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Chair Roblin, again, for the record, my name is Ron Burson. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Government Ethics Commission, and I appreciate the committee's time. I also appreciate this bill. I've spent a lot of the first part of the session on the other side of the aisle, I guess, I don't know, other side of the building, looking at Senate Bill 30. And I think this committee is going to look at Senate Bill 30 on Wednesday. And I think it will be really interesting for the committee to look at Senate Bill 30 and look at House Bill 3011 here. And because there's some decisions that need to be made in these different areas that Representative Stigler brought up. And I'd just like to point out, you know, a few of these in different areas. I know that underneath House Bill 3011, underneath the food and beverage, they talk about food and beverages, non-alcoholic beverages being exempt from the gift limitations. I think under Senate Bill 30, there's another approach to that, which we'll be able to take a look at. Legislative administrative interest is changed underneath this bill. It is also a different proposal underneath Senate Bill 30. Which I think this committee will need to look at. But one thing I think that Mr. Bishop failed to mention under legislative administrative interest is he's correct, it's a distinct economic interest, or an economic interest is distinct from the general public. But what I would point out that it gets down to subject to the action or vote of the person acting. And so underneath 3011, it's down to the action or vote of the person. Currently, right now, under the gift limitations, it's in the government agency that the public official works for. So in other words, if any vendor or any business or a person does business with the agency that that person works for, then they would have an interest and they would be underneath the gift limitations. Underneath this, it would be down to the action or vote of the person. So that person would actually need to have some type of action or vote with that vendor or with that business. Now, under Senate Bill 30, it goes even a little narrower in that it talks about the vote or decision or person. So only the decision makers or the voters that deal with those vendors would be subject to the gift limitations. Again, it's going to be a decision for this committee to look at these different areas and decide which way we want to go forward with it. As far as the statement of economic interest filers, this bill goes much further than Senate Bill 30 in adding additional filers to the statement of economic interest, and I think Representative Stigler pointed that out, that she felt that people that do have some type of authority over public funds should be filing it. And most of these additions are actually agency heads, so they have to do with the state government monies, and the agency would always be in favor of more transparent government. So, but that's again another decision that I think it has to make. So I guess I feel like it's kind of premature to talk about this without talking about 30 in the same context, or maybe on Wednesday when we talk about 30 we can look at this again. So anyway, that concludes my testimony, and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for this group? Thank you very much. And that was it. Is there anyone else here who did not sign up that would like to testify today? Seeing none, I will close the hearing on House Bill 3011, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2915. I'll have a short explanation by the administrator. Who is this bill?
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 2915 modifies the definition of public official and legislative and administrative interest for purpose of Oregon's government ethics laws, modifies gift provisions, modifies the content of the statement of economic interest, and removes the requirement to file quarterly statements. As previously discussed, Oregon's government ethics laws were substantially revised by the Legislative Assembly in 2007. Provisions dealing with the receipt of gifts, the definition of a public official, the content of statements of economic interest, and the requirement to file quarterly reports generated controversy and concern.
And so we have one person signed up, Paul Snyder with AOC.
For the record, I'm Paul Snyder. I represent the Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm appearing this afternoon in support of House Bill 2915. We'd like to express our appreciation to Representative Jensen for introducing this bill. It deals with a number of the issues that have been of concern to local officials, many of which are addressed by other bills as well. I'd like to just identify a couple of the issues that are in this piece of legislation for you. Legislative or administrative interest, I really think this is the pivotal piece of all these bills, and each one addresses the issue just a little bit differently. The difference can make a difference. In current law describes the definition of legislative or administrative interest in terms of economic interest distinct from that of the general public, which has already been discussed. In one or more bills, resolutions, regulations, proposals, or other matters subject to the action or vote of a person acting as a public official. This bill would limit that to the action or vote of the person acting in the person's capacity as a public official, and further, delete the broader provision in current law that says that legislative or administrative interest applies to the agency. So it narrows the focus to the ability of the particular public official to somehow do something that influences the economic interest of the other party. Senate Bill 30, as you've already heard, does it in a little bit different kind of way. That talks about a decision or vote of the public official. And I hope that the committee will take a little bit of time to have a discussion on the record of whatever language you wind up with and what it means to the committee itself, because that will drive a number of things, including what the Ethics Commission does, what the Attorney General's Office does, but more specifically for our concern, it's what a public official understands a legislative or administrative interest to be. And on the flip side, what a business understands a legislative or administrative interest to be. And right now, those terms are not very well understood. At least, I don't understand them all. Other things that we have in this bill, it eliminates the gift prohibition with respect to relatives. It also eliminates the listing of relatives or members of the household in the statement of economic interests. One thing it also does is to define a little bit one of the provisions in current law which lists what a relative is. It's been rather a bit of a mystery. And the current law says that a person is a relative if I can find it. An individual for whom the public official provides benefits arising from the public official's public employment, or from whom the public official receives benefits arising from that individual's employment. The issue that I have with that explanation is that I don't know that there's any agreement on what's a benefit, and therefore how this term explains what a relative is. You have to list this person on your SEI if you're filing an SEI, but I'm not sure a lot of people know what a benefit is to know who to list. or to whom the gift limitations and prohibitions apply. So I think it would be beneficial to everyone if that term were defined, and we've defined it from our understanding in this bill to say that it's somebody who receives an annuity, pension, or insurance policy arising from that individual's employment. Once again, an important aspect of this law is, and I hope a goal of the committee, and I'm sure a goal on the Senate side, is to give people enough specificity that they know when they've crossed the line. And this particular reference to benefit is problematic for our folks. Another issue in the current law has to do with the description of who is a member of a household. And right now, current law says member of a household means any person who resides with a public official. It came up in our discussions, well, suppose a public official is a co-owner of a condo in Hawaii, and you get 2 weeks slice out of that condo, and there are other people you've never met, you're never going to meet, who own the other 50 weeks in the condo. How does this explanation of member of household apply? And what we've suggested here is that a member of a household should mean someone who's domiciled with or who has the same place of abode as the public official or the candidate. These are really the highlights of the differences between this bill and some of the others that are being considered. We do appreciate the references in Senate Bill 30 to the staff advisory opinion having more weight and reliability for people to rely on, as well as the public official's manual. The switch for entertainment to say that that is, under that bill, subject to the gift limitations rather than an absolute prohibition. But once again, I think the pivotal issue that I hope the legislature will deal with some clarity, is what is a legislative or administrative interest?
You get to do 25-18. That's my bill.
No.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this witness? And thank you. And I do believe this is a conversation we need to have as we go forward. So thank you.
Thank you.
Seeing no one else, I will close the hearing on 29-15, and I will leave it to my co-chair to start the next one.
And we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2518, and the administrator will read a summary.
Thank you, Acting Chair Edwards and members of the committee. House Bill 2518 exempts from the definition of gift for purposes of ethics laws certain sums paid to a public school teacher for expenses providing extracurricular services, tutoring or coaching, expenses for accompanying students on an educational trip, and expenses from an institution of higher education for student teacher supervision if supervision is performed concurrently with a teacher's duties for a school district. In 2007, the Legislative Assembly made substantial changes to Oregon government ethics laws, including changes to the definition of gift and exemptions to the definition of gift. The exemptions found in this bill were not included in ethics reform legislation enacted during the 2007 legislative session, and there are several amendments that have been passed out.
Representative Roland.
Thank you, Chair Edwards and committee. It is great to be out here at this site and see this wonderful collection of people on this committee. This was a bill that I wrote. I was on the Rules Committee last session when we looked at Senate Bill 10, and this was a question that came up during that time, and I proposed some stuff, worked with some people from Portland to try to craft Senate Bill 10 in such a way that these educational experiences in particular that kids take when they go to Washington, D.C., when they travel overseas with their French group, when they do other of those activities, would in fact have an exemption in the bill. And as I read it, I still, and I think you'll hear from Mr. Burson, if certain things are done by the school district, they would be exempt. You have to go through a process. What happened with the implementation of this bill was that the Ethics Commission sent a letter to school districts explaining some of that, and most of them made the decision that they would cease having these activities and allowing teachers to go on them. They just didn't want to be in it. And so in the Education Committee, we heard from a number of these teachers that came and talked about programs that they were doing around the state that they had ceased to do. And we got letters from people who had paid in advance, and then the program was stopped. And so they got somewhat of a refund, but not entirely. But the bigger problem was that so many of them, the younger brothers and sisters, had gone on this trip. It was a great experience. It was something that had really been a life-changing, positive educational experience for these kids, and no longer would their younger siblings be able to do it. And so after hearing that, I decided it would probably be the best course would just be to exempt those kinds of travel from the ethics law, so that we clearly understood that school districts could go back to the procedures that they were using before. In the school from which I was principal, we made it very clear to people when teachers were taking these trips and kids were fundraising, our school board knew about it. They talked about the educational experience. Kids came and gave presentations about the experiences they had. And it was understood by everyone there that they raised money at different times. They took that money to buy the tickets, and if there were X number of students that went for every six or seven, depending on the program you went with, an adult chaperone would also be paid, and usually that was the teacher. Oftentimes, if we got to 12, it was a teacher plus a parent or a second teacher, but the issue was that first one generally was the teacher because they were going on this particular experience to supplement some of the kinds of things that they'd been doing in the classroom. And from middle school to high school, all we got were rave reviews about these programs and the importance that they had to those students. And so what this bill simply, when we started to do, was to make sure that those activities continued and that we recognized the advantages of them. And clearly, I think that any program that's doing that, they should explain that teacher's travel is being paid for. I mean, I think that should be a part, and certainly in our school we made sure that everybody understood that. But I think that what happened after we did that is there came a number of amendments. So there are four of them. One was, and I should have thought of this from the very beginning, oftentimes it's not just the teacher that goes. There are other school employees who have also accompanied and worked in these programs, and so it should include all school employees. And then there was because of the relating clause, a number of other people started talking to us about amendments. So you'll see there are four amendments. I think most of them are compatible. But one has to do with stipends that are paid. I think there's some issues that you'll hear about later about how that works. Also, there are trips that happen that get colleges and community colleges, and we should include those people as well if they're considering this kind of thing. So I think the amendments take care of it. You'll have other people talk about it. I think that one of the really important things to me, and that was rather gratifying at the hearings that we had in the Education Department, I always felt that these programs were really great, and my children took advantage of them, going both to England and to Washington, D.C. and New York, and they came back with amazing stories about the experiences that they got to have. We got to hear that again. I mean, it affirms the fact that we have a lot of dedicated teachers that are willing to take their time, which is a valuable commodity, and then go in the summer and take these kids and help them have a better experience than they would have had actually with their parent, because they brought with them the experience of having done it before and the kinds of things to look for and the planning of the activities. I think they're valuable things to this education of our children in Oregon, and would love to hear if other people have some ideas to make it even better, but that's why it's here. And if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you. Representative Jensen.
Yes, I agree.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, Representative. Are there people who actually think that it's a gift to take a bunch of students halfway around the world and assume the responsibility for those people's well-being at the same time?
There appears to be people who believe that to be the case.
I'll be darned.
And Representative Jensen, I had the same thoughts on the last bill regarding whether or not it's actually considered a gift to have to go to yet another function and eat rubber chicken. So,
Representative Jensen, I'm sure that if you behave very well and are very kind, we could arrange for you to have a gift of, you know, 40 middle schoolers to be responsible for a week.
Believe me, if the criterion for that is behaving very well, I will make it a point not to.
Anything else for Representative Roblin?
That by itself would be worth seeing.
Thank you very much.
Trust me.
Thank you.
Never tempt the representative.
Okay, next we'll call up Ron Burson and Bruce Bishop.
And hopefully we'll get that First Amendment around to everybody.
Is there a dash one?
Yes. And we were just mentioning, we didn't get the dash ones around everybody. We've had them for a while. But they are the ones that I think clearly articulate that it's not just teachers. It's all employees. And with that, Representative Burson. I mean, Representative, sorry. Oh. Ron Burson.
Yeah, just an executive official from the Ethics Commission. And I appreciate the committee's time on this. Again, my name is Ron Burson. I'm the executive director for the Oregon Government Ethics Commission, and I attended the hearings on with the educational subcommittee, and I appreciate not being called up during those hearings because I don't think I'd have been very favorable there. But I just want to, I guess, point out a couple of things on these trips. In Senate Bill 10. Severely restricted the travel of any public officials, and school teachers like yourselves and myself all fall underneath the definition of a public official. And so there were a couple of ways that public officials could still travel underneath Senate Bill 10. One was to accept that travel from another government, either another state, the federal government, a Native American tribe, a not-for-profit business, a 501c3 that receives less than 5% of its funds from a for-profit corporation, and you needed to be representing yourself as a public official during that travel. There was also the allowance of travel that was sanctioned that would be funded by outside of government entities. And what the agency came down to say sanctioning was is that your supervising body or your supervisor would sanction that travel. In other words, you as a public official just couldn't make your own decision to travel. You needed to make sure that somebody in authority above yourself knew that you were going to travel and knew that you were going to be accepting private funds for that travel. And this instance with the teacher travel fell underneath that guideline. And simply what the agency said in its opinion, and by the way, the agency was approached and asked this question. We don't normally go out and solicit this type or, you know, offer up this type of advice. We're asked this advice. And so we were asked the question on teacher travel. And so we went back and looked at the exceptions that Senate Bill 10 allowed in the law, and we came out with an opinion. That opinion said that a teacher would be allowed to travel if they did one of two things. They could either separate themselves and have an outside employment, and then we gave some guidelines for outside employment. In other words, they really weren't the teacher at that time. They were going to be employed by this private business that was doing the travel. And I think that's important for folks to realize too, this is a private business offering this travel. It is not the school. It is, in fact, it's not a school-sanctioned event. The other thing is that the other way they could travel is that they could have this travel sanctioned by their by their school board, by their principal, by somebody other than themselves in authority inside that. And actually the agency gave quite a bit of leeway on that sanctioning. I mean, we really didn't say it had to be the school board that sanctioned it. We just said somebody in authority above that, and that was in our administrative rules. So a teacher could travel underneath those two ways of doing that. So now this bill would give a specific, you know, exemption for this type of travel. I think we really need to make sure that we wrap, if we're going to do this, that we wrap all the travel in. Because we've also given out an opinion from a teacher from McNary High School here that had a program that went to Germany. And this program was actually funded by the federal government. They did put some funding in, and so then it fell underneath the first exception that I talked about. It was, and they didn't have to have any sanctioning, and they were allowed to go. But if we're gonna exempt them, we need to make sure that we encompass all the types of travel. We tried to explore that with our opinion, and we found there was about four different ways that people travel out there, and I'd be happy to offer that information to the committee. The second thing I wanted to talk about that's in the bill is this idea of student teaching, the paying of the stipends for student teachers. In the state of Oregon, student teachers are students that want to be teachers are required to student teach and to be licensed by the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. And what we were asked the question is that private universities were actually paying the teachers directly for the student teachers coming into their classroom. So they were either paying them with money or they were paying them with credits at their college. So an example, Lewis and Clark would place a student teacher into a classroom. They would either pay that teacher dollars for mentoring that student, or they would pay them credits at Lewis and Clark that person could cash in to take classes at Lewis and Clark. And we were asked the question, is that allowed underneath the ethics laws? What we said is that direct payment was not allowed underneath the ethics laws, that payment would need to go through the payroll system. And the reason that we said that is that compensation is exempt from the gift limitations, but a direct payment from a private entity is not. Now, also during this process of this staff opinion that the agency worked on, is we also talked with many of the state universities, and the state universities actually do run their program through the school district's payroll system. In other words, they pay the school pays the teacher a stipend similar to what a coach would get or somebody else would get at the school. And what they have found, especially with talking with the University of Oregon, was they have a very difficult time placing their students because they can't compete with the private universities that are actually paying the teacher directly. The other area of concern that we had is that we could not find any records of any of these payments. In other words, we could not find any documentation of the payment. So therefore, there was no documentation that the public official was actually being paid any money. In other words, for tax records, we had found no 1099s from any of these schools they could produce for us. And so what we simply said was to run those payments through the school district's payroll system. We actually did meet with Teacher Standards and Practices because, as you can tell, they probably had a lot of concerns about this because it's part of their licensing program. And after the discussions, it was actually their conclusion that this would kind of even the playing field. In other words, the private universities would be on the same playing field as the public universities as far as placing their students in classrooms around the state. So those are just a couple of things I'd like to say about the bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yep. Mr. Chair, members, speaking for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on my own behalf and not as a lobbyist. Although in my experience of over 21 years of lobbying in this building, I've learned that it's not a good idea to testify at 5 o'clock against the chairman's bill. As a result of that lesson, I am not here to oppose the bill. In fact, I think these kinds of trips are a good idea. Our daughter participated in one when she graduated from middle school. She went to the East Coast and traveled from Boston all the way through Philadelphia, D.C., and down to Williamsburg. When she came back from that trip, she decided that she was not interested in attending Harvard. So that one trip saved us a lot of money and was definitely worth the investment that we made in it. But what I want to do is to use this bill as an opportunity to explain again the complicated dilemmas that we're presenting for public officials in understanding what the ethics laws are and what the standards that they're expected to comply with are.
And it will surprise Mr. Burson, I'm sure, but I agree with much of what he just testified about the problems in this area. Let me focus on one example, and I've given you some written testimony that raises other issues that your amendments may get at. I haven't looked at those amendments. But one of the problems here, I believe, is that the bill would carve out for some public officials related to schools the payment of reasonable expenses for their participation in these activities. Again, it's not clear what a reasonable expense is, but even if the reasonable expense is the payment of travel and lodging and meals, I'm not sure that that provision is sufficient to overcome the limitation in the law for the payment of honoraria. Honoraria are a separate type of payment that public officials receive for services that they provide for which a value cannot be set. So it's not clear to me in some of these situations whether teachers or others who participate in these kinds of activities are getting paid for their expenses or if they're getting paid for their services as public officials. And I think you're going to want to be careful not just to exempt, if that's your decision, what a reasonable expense is, but what other payments may be, because I think in some of these situations, they're actually payments for services which may be honoraria and subject to different limits. The committee may want to look at whether it needs to not only exempt some activities from the gift limitations, but from the limitations on honoraria as well. With that as an example, I'll conclude my testimony and just remind the committee that these are very complicated issues that you're dealing with, in part because Representative David Edwards apparently did not provide the committee with a quotation earlier in the hearing. I want to point out at the end of my testimony, I have an excerpt from Robert Frost's Mending Wall that says, before I built a wall, I'd like to know what I was walling in or walling out and to whom I was like to give offense. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. And this process isn't exactly poetry, but it's like building a wall. And you're building some walls here that are going to define what are permissible and impermissible conduct for public officials. So I urge you to be careful when you decide who you're walling in and who you're walling out.
Thank you for that. And any questions? Seeing none. We have three more people. We're running a little late. I think we can get those in if people stay. I know a few people have to leave. If they do, I'll just take the testimony. So Gary, Andine, Justin Black, and George Auklich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Gary Ann Dean. I'm the president of the Oregon Independent Colleges Association. We don't need to spend a lot of time rehashing what's in 2518 regarding teacher education and mentor teachers. 11 of my 20 institutions do teacher education programs in the state. They generate about 38% of all the teacher education degrees in the state. And as you've already heard, it's a requirement that all those student teachers have mentored experiences in the public schools before they graduate. It has been custom for many, many, many years for the teacher education program directors to seek out and then hold on to dearly good mentor teachers in the public schools. Once you find those people, you don't like to lose them. It's particularly tough to find them these days because those same mentor teachers are under the obligation to perform with No Child Left Behind. So anytime they give up in front of their students to help a student teacher is time that they are very jealous of. What happened this last year with the ethics law is that, as was described to you, the only real way we could work around the situation was to go through the school districts and ask the school districts to put these compensations, these stipends, if you will, into the teacher contract. Most of the school districts said, well, that's just one more headache. We're going to charge you an administrative overhead to do that, which is the way we managed to do it this year. The other problem with that, of course, is that it puts the school district between the mentor teacher and the college Department of Education, so that it makes it more difficult to build those kind of relationships that you like to have with your mentor teachers. For your information, the stipends or the honoraria run between usually $100 and $200 for a whole semester's work. Occasionally, if a college does have some summer school continuing education programs, a credit or two might be offered to. These are not large amounts of money. And we've certainly been willing to look to talk about ways that we could document that money exchange. For instance, one of the schools suggested that maybe they could bring those mentor teachers on as adjunct faculty. That seemed to present other problems. So we would like this exemption. We have a couple of alternative ways to phrase the exemption that's already in the bill right now that the chair has in -3 amendments. So I'll be happy to take any questions.
We'll listen to all three, and then if we have any questions, so.
For the record, my name is George O'Coolidge here on behalf of the Nike School Innovation Fund, specifically talking about the -4 amendments. In the beginning of 2007, Nike, recognizing the importance of public schools in Oregon, invested $9 million into the Nike School Innovation Fund in partnership with the Portland Business Alliance Charitable Institute. This is a program that specifically set up three sort of principles that they wanted to instigate in terms of innovation, education, and leadership. In the first year, the 07-08, first year the program was started, they gave about $1.6 million in grant funding to the Beaverton, Hillsboro, and Portland Public Schools, specifically working with the superintendents and teachers at these school districts, looking for ways of, like I specifically sort of leadership areas where superintendents, you know, might not have had the resources but wanted to do some sort of, specific sort of programs they did. I have sort of a packet that I will pass out to you guys, but it's just some examples. There was the sort of the Summer Academy, which there have been several hundreds of kids from the Hillsboro, Beaverton, and Portland Public School Districts gone through this Summer Academy to get kids ready for kindergarten. Another grant has been for sort of working with teachers in terms of doing a sort of a mentor-teacher program in terms of getting them, bringing experts out who work with teachers and stuff like that. Also sort of, a lot of teachers would like to become sort of principals and administrators in school districts and trying to get them in these, sort of connected with mentors. After the 07-08 year, after Senate Bill 10 came into effect, the Nike School Innovation Fund did ask for an ethics opinion out of the commission and was told they could not do so, continue doing that grant funding. So the -4 before you is sort of our initial read at trying to solve that. I got the amendment on Friday. I just read it over, would have suggestions for sort of narrowing it. I think right now, as it's read, it's pretty broad. But I'd like the opportunity to continue working with the committee administrator and the committee on trying to find something so that the Nike School Innovation Fund can continue doing this funding.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Justin Black from the Oregon Education Association. We represent somewhere over 48,000 members who work in public education from kindergarten to community college and everywhere in between. I want to talk about a couple things. The House Education Committee got a good presentation from a group of middle schoolers and a couple of our members about the value of these trips. I thought today you all seemed to get that, so I won't go much into that. But what I do want to address is some of the comments Mr. Bearson made about where the Ethics Commission came down on school travel and what our hope with this bill is. He is correct about how he said ways in which you know, our members and students could take these travels. What we're hoping for this bill to accomplish is to take some of those barriers down. We did have some members that were able to navigate kind of a, you know, they did not speak about the trip during school hours. They did not speak about the trip during school and would only talk about it outside of school, and they were able to kind of put somewhat of a trip together, but not to the level that they had had before, where they were able to invite numbers of students to the travel and really kind of broaden the outreach, which they had. The new rules kind of limited their scope of who they were able to talk to, when they were able to talk, and really not engage the number of students that they would have hoped to. Another kind of barrier that has happened is that districts have just said, this is too much trouble for us. We ask that you not do these trips. We're hoping that this lowers the bar so that they are able to go back on these trips. We have yet to find a school district, I think, that has been willing to acknowledge the trips and take on the responsibility of the trips. So we're hoping that this lowers that bar and gets us back into the stage where our members and students can go on these trips that everybody sees value in. And I will leave it at that.
Questions for these witnesses? Seeing none. I look forward to working with all of you to get the language right so that we can do it. And with you too, Ron. So thank you very much. Is there anyone else here who was jumping for the chance to come and testify at 5:10? Seeing none, I will close the hearing on House Bill 2518. And so we're just going to, any information anybody has? Okay. We're going to close the hearing, or the rules meeting. Thank you very much.